Right. Now the lecture is being recorded. Thank you for reminding me. Fortunately, that came before I got to actual content. Anything else before I plow ahead? Okay. So we're going to start today talking about a particular state machine that our textbook also discusses at some length. And sort of explore a few concepts in this, and then we'll use that to transition to the implicit state machine of code that will be used throughout computing as you continue in subsequent courses. And the task we're going to deal with has to do with how a bishop can move in a chess set. You don't actually need to understand chess for this to work. I'm going to explain to you everything you need to know. The concept of chess is there is a grid. And there are different pieces, and they have different rules about how they can move. The bishop's rule is a particular piece, is the bishop can only move diagonally, any distance they want, but only diagonally. So we have the bishop can move one square diagonally, or two squares diagonally, or three squares diagonally, in any diagonal direction you happen to pick, as far as it wants to go, as long as that motion is only diagonal. Okay, never allowed to move straight, not allowed to move in another pattern. And so we're going to sort of think about what's the implicit state machine of our bishop. How can the bishop move? Okay, so if we think about the bishop's position, there's lots of ways we could handle this. But one of those is to say that the bishop has a position, x, y. We could just number rows and columns of our grid here, and get our bishop's position. And any given xy could transition to, a single move could transition to x plus one, y, I don't know, let's say plus one, let's use the mathematician's y goes up instead of the computer scientist's y go down, why not? And it could go to x plus one, y minus one, and it could go to x minus 1, y minus 1. And it could go to x minus 1, y plus 1. And of course, there's nothing special about the ones, right? It can also go, for example, to x minus 3, y minus 3. So we have this state machine that if we assume our chessboard is unbounded, this is an infinite number of transitions. Any state we happen to be in could transition to any arbitrary number of other states. In particular, if we consider the state xy, it has a transition to x plus or minus a, y plus or minus a for all a. For all integer a, I suppose I should say. Okay, you can go to any of these states. And probably just the ones that are positive, because usually we don't allow pieces to stay put in chess, although that's not hugely important. But we have this state machine, we can analyze this, even though it has an infinite number of transitions and a potentially infinite number of states. And in analyzing this, we're going to ask ourselves, we're going to try to do the following theorem. Okay, the theorem we're going to start with is no set of moves gets from xy to x plus 1y. There is no way, no number of moves you can possibly take that will get you one square adjacent to where you started. This is a theorem, something that if you've played chess, you're already familiar with, but this is a basic theorem that we're just going to try to prove about our state machine. We want to show that our state machine has an unreachable state. If xy can be reached, then x plus 1y cannot. But how do we prove this? Okay, because the number of moves could be infinite. And so if we were to start with our standard way of saying no set of something exists, we would start by contradiction, assume such a state exists, and then try to arrive at a contradiction. But what would be the contradiction? if we tried to do induction on the length of the path, what is the thing we are saying still holds at every given step? Okay. And so often when we're dealing with state machines and other stateful systems, we're going to want what is called an invariant. An invariant is a predicate that doesn't change when you transition from one state to the next. It does not vary. It is true regardless of what happens. All of the existing transitions, if it was true, keep it true. If it was false, keep it false. It does not vary. It doesn't even need to be a predicate. It could be any function. I could make a function that returns an integer and I show the integer doesn't change. There's lots of these kinds of things we could deal with. But invariants are usually how we deal with large state. We say something can't change, and then all we need to do to show that you can't get from one to the other is say whatever that thing is that can't change, it was different between those two. If whatever the thing is different in one of these than it is in the other, and we can't change it, then we couldn't have gotten from one to the other. Now, in chess, the invariant that a bishop has is the color of the square. Chessboards traditionally have a dark color and a light color. We'll call it black and white for lack of a better phrase. And if a bishop is on a black square, by nature of moving diagonally, it will always end up on another black square. And it can never end up on a white square. Okay? So that's the concept we're going to try to do. We want this idea of the color of the square. But that's only going to be useful if we have access to color. And when I just say there's a grid, I don't immediately have access to color. So I need to have a mathematical representation of the concept that's represented by the color of the square. So let's dive back a little bit into some of our understanding about numbers and number theory to figure out what that invariant is. Then we'll come back and think about this proof. So, let's come in again and let's just pick some coordinates and see what we think they are. Let's just arbitrarily say that this is square 0, 0 and that it's black. And then we can try to look and say, well, we know that 1, 1 is going to be black and 2, 2 is going to be black and 3, 3 is going to be black and 4, 4 is going to be black. Okay, we also know that 2, 0 is going to be black, and 0, 2 is going to be black, so is 0, 4, and 4, 0. Also, 4, 2, and 2, 4. Also, 1, 3, and 3, 1. And if we just look at sort of these things, those are the black cells, right? We're doing this checkerboarding thing. And we want to know what is a property that all of these squares have that all the squares I didn't have don't have, right? So if we think about the square 0, 1, it has a different property. If we think about the square 0, 3, it has a different property. If we think about the square 2, 3, it has a different property. Now, this is a thing that I think is surprising to some people as they're starting to understand how math works. Math is originally taught as being so rigid and formulaic and so on. But when you get to the space of proofs, there's a level at which you look at things and are creative. We come up with something that appears to work. And as I look at this particular data, I will notice that if I'm black, then x plus y is even. And for these red numbers, x plus y is odd. How did I come up with that? Well, I saw somebody else do it. I looked at the numbers for a while. I thought about what diagonal means. There's different ways I can get there, but fundamentally, it's an act of creativity, mine or somebody else's. I understand what is going on here, and I notice a pattern. Once I notice a pattern, it's important to verify it, okay? And I can verify this in various ways. One way to verify this is to notice that if I go straight, I always change even sums to odd. One of the two numbers changes by one, and so I always change even to odd. So if this happened to be an odd number, then all of these will be even. And that gives me the checkerboard behavior I want, right? All of the things that the even can reach will be odd. And so I'm going to have this behavior that every even square is surrounded by odd squares, every odd square is surrounded by even squares, which is the desired behavior of a checkerboard. And so I can say, ah, this works. I have a checkerboard formula. I want to verify this. I could just use this as the definition, but I want to make sure it matches the real world I am trying to model. So given that I know from experience, playing around with the game a bit, that my knight can, if it starts on a black square, has to stay on a black square, and I know that that just means that the even oddness can't change, then I can come up with an invariant, a mathematical invariant, okay? My mathematical invariant is that x plus y mod 2 is invariant. Moving states doesn't change this number. It's either a 0 or a 1, and it's always either a 0 or 1. All moves keep it the same. Okay? This being my representation of evenness or oddness. I could also say there's a special word for this. This is called the parity. Parity refers to the even oddness of a number. So I could say the parity of x plus y is an invariant. I could also define some predicate of xy to be x plus y is odd, for example. This would also be an invariant. If it's true, it's always true. If it's false, it's always false. These are all sort of different ways of expressing the same fundamental characteristic of my system. But I identify the invariant. And once I have the invariant, I can now proceed to try to make this proof. Okay? This is going to require two basic steps. And it's going to look somewhat like a proof by induction, although it's not quite the same. Okay, my proof structure is going to be, so if we think about my proof, okay, I'm going to have two pieces. I'm going to prove that the invariant is invariant. I prove that this thing can't change as I transition. That's part of my proof. And the other part of my proof is that the start and end have different invariant values. And then there is a proof by induction going on here, right? I am saying that by induction, I know a single step can't change things, so by induction, the in step has to have the same as the initial step, but I knew it didn't. So I end up with an induction by contradiction proof. Let's see if we can work through that in its full glory. Okay, so our proof is going to run as follows. We're going to say, let's define. We'll use the parity of, Zoom is doing weird things on me, sorry. The parity of x plus y is going to be x plus y mod 2, okay? We'll call it zero parity if that's an even sum, odd parity if it's a one parity if it's odd. Okay. And so now we're going to start by having this proof that says for all transitions, for all transitions, our parity is unchanged. This is going to be our first part of the proof. When we have this thing that looks like a theorem, but isn't the theorem we're trying to prove, it's a helper, we typically call it a lemma. Lemma is a special word for a theorem that isn't interesting in its own right. It's interesting as part of the help of what we're trying to show. So here's our lemma. For all transitions, parity is unchanged. And we're going to prove that by saying we're going to use universal instantiation. We're going to just say a transition is xy to x plus or minus a, y plus or minus a. I don't know which one of these it is. Okay. So I'm going to consider the cases. I don't know if these have the same sign or the different sign. So we're going to take the case X plus A, Y plus A. If that's the new state, then that is going to suggest that I have X plus Y plus 2A. And that mod 2, I don't know what X plus Y mod 2 is, but I do know what the 2A term mod 2 is. It's 0, because 2A is even. So that is going to equal X plus Y mod A, mod 2, because the 2A is even. And even numbers mod 2 go away. Adding an even number doesn't change what's going on. And then I could also take the case X plus A, Y minus A. We have different signs for the two numbers. And this is going to give me X plus Y plus A minus A. So that's just X plus Y. And so X plus Y mod 2 is equal to X plus Y mod 2. That's trivial. I don't have to do any special work. The A is canceled. And if I allow my A's to be negative, this is all of the transitions, right? Same sign, different sign, positive or negative A's. I have now shown that this transition always preserves this parity definition I have provided. This is the lemma. Now that I have the lemma, I can try to do the actual theorem. I can say, from xy, xy plus 1 is unreachable. Okay, so how can I show that it's unreachable? Well, to show something can't be done, I generally assume it can be done and show a contradiction. So we're going to assume, use contradiction. Okay, so we're going to assume it is reachable. Then, by the lemma, x, y, and x, y plus 1 have the same parity. Let me pause for a moment. This is not what the lemma says. The lemma does not say that reachable states have the same parity. It says that a single transition doesn't change parity. Depending on my audience, I might assume they can do the inductive step in their head. But I might be wrong. Let's see what we're really doing here. Okay, this is going to be the conclusion of a subproof by induction. Okay, so how does that subproof by induction work? We're going to have our base case, no transitions. Maybe we didn't have to move at all to reach where we're going. And this is trivially true. XY and XY have the same parity because they are the same value. And then induction. Okay, my induction is going to say, assume that K transitions does not change parity. Then K plus 1 does not. Okay, and the way this works is we are going to take the last transition. So our last step, we know the first K steps we got for free. The last transition is handled by the lemma. Okay. I'm clearly glossing over some details here, but this is the idea. I know that because a single step doesn't change things, an arbitrary number of steps can't change things by induction. Zero steps doesn't change it. One more step than I already have doesn't change it. So depending on my level of detail, I might include a proof by induction inside my proof by contradiction. Okay, so let's go back out to our proof by contradiction. We have this assumption that we can reach this state. We have this lemma that we've been able to use that shows that means they have to have the same parity. And then we can say, but x plus y mod 2 does not equal x plus y plus 1 mod 2. How can we make this argument? Well, there's various ways we could do this. We could just sort of appeal to what modulo means. We could also just assign this a value and say that is z, and then figure out that this other value must be 1 minus z. There's different approaches we could do here, but we can just use our basic understanding of number theory to show that these have different parity. And that results in a contradiction. Okay, in particular, we showed that they have the same parity, and we showed they have different parity. Those two things contradict. And that therefore means that our original theorem, that you can, that this thing is unreachable, must be true, because assuming it's false meant it was false. Whew. Okay. Any thoughts, comments, questions, any piece of this you'd like me to say more about? What did you say for the base case of my subproof? Base case is there's no transitions. Trivially, that means they have the same parity because I haven't transitioned. I'm starting at xy, I'm ending at xy, therefore I know they have the same parity. Let me say that more clearly. And I say trivially because a function on the same input returns the same output. Other questions? Okay. So, why did I do this? Why spend all this effort to prove something that anybody that has played chess for a few minutes already knows, that bishops can't leave their color? I did this because the principles we're using here are also going to apply to much more complicated situations, in particular to code. When we want to prove the correctness of code, in almost every case, the difficult part, the part that requires creativity, is detecting the invariant. Over the years, we've gotten better and better at writing computer programs that will do all of the other steps of analyzing our code for us. But what's going to challenge them is when they get to a loop. A loop is going to exercise a transition, changing state each time through the loop a number of times. And it's going to be difficult to reason about all of that number in advance. So what we need to know is, what's invariant? What is the thing that doesn't change regardless of how many times the loop transition occurs? And once we know the invariant of the loop, then we can try to verify both that the loop satisfies it and that it results in the theorem we want. And so a great deal of provable correctness of code, proving any theorem about code, involves the human coming up with the loop invariants, identifying what doesn't change in this loop, and then allowing a software that uses our basic logic rules and arithmetic rules and so on to sort of manipulate the rest of the proof. To explore that a little bit more, let's discuss one of the very first published algorithms. Euclid's algorithm has been around, published for more than 2,000 years. Okay, and I'm going to show you not quite the way Euclid did, because you know we've changed how we word things over the years. But this is a function to find the GCD. Okay, The GCD of A, B. You know what? Let me actually write it out in full glory with all of its pieces because it'll make our lives slightly easier, okay? How do I find the greatest common divisor of two values? First, I'm going to just do a little bit of bookkeeping. I'm going to say that I want A to be the smaller of the two values. So if A is greater than B, I'm going to swap A and B. Exactly how you swap values in your languages can vary a little bit between what's going on, but we're just going to assume we can do this, however swapping occurs. And then I'm going to have a while loop. While A is not zero, okay? I'm going to iterate something until A becomes zero. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that bigger number and subtract from it the smaller number. I know B is the bigger number because if it wasn't originally, I have swapped them to make it the bigger number. And then I'm going to keep B the bigger number by saying if B has now become less than A, I'm going to swap again. A and B. And I should probably use the same looking creation in both cases. So we'll say B less than A in both cases just for uniformity. And then I'm going to return A. This is the whole algorithm. This is Euclid's algorithm for finding the GCD. And it works. It's been around for more than 2,000 years. We know it works. We've been using it for a long time. Not A, sorry, return B. That just always returns zero, return B. Okay. How can I prove that this works? How can I verify that this is a working thing? Well, I could certainly just try it out on a lot of numbers, but that isn't a proof. Tests are not proofs unless I can exhaustively test. I want to prove this transition of state. Notice my state is the value of A and B, both of which could be arbitrary integers. So I have a pair of arbitrary integers. I have an infinitely large state space. Or even if you code this in something where integers can only have a certain number of bits, I still have a gargantuanly large state space. And I don't know how many transitions I am taking. My while loop changes A and B, but I don't know how many times it's going to run. I don't know how many transitions are going to be taken. So what I want to show is that the end result of this transition, however many times it hasn't changed the original GCD. Okay? How can I show that it hasn't changed the original GCD? Well, let's think about this as a state machine, and let's come up with its invariant and see where we go from there. All right, my basic structure. I have A, B states. If you give me an A, B state, I either am always transitioning to one of two next states after an iteration of the loop. I'm always subtracting A from B, but I might be swapping the results. So I might go to A, B minus A, or I might go to B minus A, A. I'll only go to one of those two. Any given state only goes to one of the two, but those are the only two transitions that a single step of my loop has as I look at my state machine. So let's sort of mark that as an OR. This is an either OR. In particular, this is an XOR, right? I have only one of these two that's going on. And I want an invariant. Because I know what the function is supposed to do, I know something about that invariant. That invariant had better preserve the GCD. If it fails to preserve the GCD, then I'm in trouble. So what I need to show, I need to have my invariant show that the GCD of AB is equal to the GCD of A, B minus A. And because GCD doesn't care about the order of its operands, that is to say, it's a transitive operator, it doesn't matter that there's two different ways to go here. The invariant can be an invariant either way. I actually also have an invariant that A is no greater than B, and a few other things that we can deal with. But let's start with just this one. So I have this invariant. Now, as I start looking at this invariant, I'm very rapidly going to realize this is a false invariant. And I can find an example where this is not invariant just by using one for A and B. The greatest common divisor of one and one is one. The greatest common divisor of one and zero is undefined because zero has no divisors. Similarly, if I pick any other number that's the same number twice, the GCD should be that number, but the GCD of that thing and zero is wrong. However, notice I don't have to worry about that case. I have made my while loop add an extra condition. So it fails in this case, but that case is banned. Because once I get to the case where one of these things is zero, I'm going to return the other one. Okay? So I don't have to worry about that transition. That transition goes somewhere else. In particular, that transition goes to return the bigger number, which is the in the value. So I have this case that x equal the a equals b. And in that case, we return b. Oh, we return a rather, right? But they're the same number, which is the GCD. So I'm good in the case where you gave me the same number twice. I'm going to have the right behavior. I'm going to keep the right value. And then let's consider the case where A does not equal B. Okay, now, if we think about what a GCD means, if they have a GCD, let's suppose their GCD was X. Let's just arbitrarily call the GCD of A, B is equal to X. So we have a number we can use in our future values. What that means is that X is a divisor of both A and B. So that means, in particular, I can rewrite this as X times A over X, where A over X is an integer. And I can write this as X over B over X, where B over X is an integer. Well, if I'm subtracting those, okay, so I have B minus A, that means I've got X times B over X minus X times A over X. Okay. Since I know this is an integer and that's an integer, I know this is going to be equal to B over X minus A over X, which is also going to be an integer. And you'll realize I still have my X factor. So the GCD is preserved. My invariant holds. I could certainly work through this in more detail, but I want to sort of finish out how all of this works. So if you have questions about how this goes, I'm happy to answer them. My intention is to plow ahead. I have an invariant. Doing a single step of the loop doesn't change the GCD of AB. Unless, of course, it makes one of them zero, in which case we're returning. So as long as we haven't reached that case, we're moving forward fine. Well, that tells me that at the end, I'm returning some number where I do have the right GCD. And I know in particular, I'm returning this special value where one of them was zero, which means the previous state was they were the same. That isn't quite enough to finish analyzing my code because I haven't shown that this loop ever ends. Maybe this loop spins forever. So part of what I want to show is that I haven't removed the GCD, but I also have to note that I reached the GCD. Okay, so I also have to note that I'm going to make progress. And so as I think about progress, I want something that isn't an invariant, something that moves in some direction. And I can say each transition, that is to say each loop of the step, each step of the loop makes A plus B smaller. Okay, at every given point, one of the two numbers is shrinking. Therefore, the sum of the two numbers is shrinking. The only way it could not shrink was if one of the numbers was zero, but we wouldn't be in the loop if we got to that position. So we are continually shrinking the numbers while preserving their GCD. Okay, so from this side, we know that we're getting smaller numbers. And from this side, we know that they have the same GCD. And if we make smaller numbers with the same GCD, we have to eventually leave the loop. Why do I know they have to eventually leave the loop? Because there is a smallest number with the same GCD. And so I have to eventually reach that value. I can't avoid reaching that value. The only way to avoid that reaching value, we have A become zero earlier. And if A becomes zero earlier, then the step before that was the two numbers were the same, which means they had the same GCD. And so when I put all of this together, I can look at some code. I can find the invariant, prove the invariant holds, prove the loop does not violate the invariant. Also prove the loop makes progress. And the end consequence is that I have a proof that the function does what I want it to do. Or at least the outline of such a proof that we've presented in class today. Thoughts, comments, questions? Okay. Where does all of this lead? We have invariants. State machines are easier to prove if we know what their invariant is. We find the invariant by inspection and creativity. We figure out what it is. Although often that creativity actually occurred in the design of the algorithm. If you can name the code that is essentially just the loop, then you have the name of the loop invariant. So understanding your own code will help you come up with these invariants. And once you know the invariant, you can prove that it holds, prove you make progress, and you end up being able to prove something about your actual program. What does your program do? And this is the core of proving all kinds of different algorithms. But it gets messy. Let's consider sort a list. Sorting is a small enough problem that we can easily describe it. It's a complicated enough problem. There are dozens of algorithms for it. And so it's not quite as simple as the GCD, where I can outline the whole proof in a single slide. But it is the sort of thing that we hope we can prove. I want to prove that a sorting algorithm successfully sorts a list. But that's an awkward thing to do, okay? Let's consider just a sort of a very vaguely stated algorithm. Let's suppose my algorithm is find an out of order pair and swap them. Okay, now this is not a fully defined algorithm. I can't completely write this in code because finding, I didn't tell you how to find. But let's just verify first that this will result in sorting at least an example list. So let's consider a list 3, 1, 4, 1, 5, 9. Okay, and let's suppose I want to sort it from smallest to largest. So what this means is I have to find a number. An out-of-order pair would be a pair of numbers where the first one is bigger than the second one. And I, as it turns out, I have three such pairs. I have this one, and I have this one. I can pick any one of them. It doesn't matter which one I pick. Let's pick the first one I identified first. So I can go to 3, 1, 1, 4, 5, 9. And now I have just two out of order pairs. I've removed one of the out of order pairs. Okay, and so then I can do another swap. I can change this to 1, 3, 1, 4, 5, 9. I have one fewer out of order pair, and so I can swap that. 1, 1, 3, 4, 5, 9. Now, some cases will be more complicated than this, but this is the idea. But if I were to think about the state machine here, I would need to have an invariant. What is it that is invariant, that doesn't change, And or what is it that makes progress in this algorithm? How can I verify that I have some sort of invariant or progress? And this turns out to be surprisingly challenging to define for this algorithm. What is the thing that never changes? Well, I've got a lot of things that never change. My list length never changes. So I have lots of invariants I could think of. My list length never changes. The elements in the list it contains never change. So that's cool. Those are important things for a sorted list. It should have the same length with the same elements. I'm not really seeing how I'm making progress. It's not clear where the progress is happening. Remember, as we thought about our GCD, one of the things I need to show is A plus B becomes smaller. What's becoming smaller here? How is it becoming less out of order? Now, one thing I could think of is here I have three out of order pairs, here I have two, and here I have one. So maybe I could say I'm making progress in the number of out of order pairs that exist. But to verify that, I would have to make sure that in all cases, for every possible set of things, I have this behavior going on. And so if we wanted to fully analyze this, we would have to sort of make some sort of generalization. We have some sort of prefix. We have one element we're sorting. We have the stuff in the middle. We have the next element we're swapping. And we have the postfix. Okay? And to fully analyze this and show that it makes progress, what we would need to show is that any out-of-order pairs involving the prefix are unchanged. Any out-of-order pairs affecting the postfix are unchanged. The specific AB out-of-order is changed. But then we'd have to argue that, but what about the things in between? Is there any chance those things in between could cause more out-of-ordering to occur? And after we analyze that, we could then say, we could either say we're done if it worked out, or we could say, we need to add more constraints or another measure. So invariants are important, but we also need this sort of progress function. What is the thing that is getting smaller? What is the badness that's going to zero? Why should I believe my process will eventually terminate? And so as you go forth in other classes that depend on this, you'll get to start to see some of these kinds of proofs. They're very often going to skip over sort of why we did what they were doing. But at their core, they're trying to show I'm not breaking anything, and I'm eventually reaching my goal in this state machine that is computer code. And figuring out what both of these are can require some creativity. It can look like magic. When somebody just tells you, here is the thing that doesn't change, here is the thing that makes progress, and you might wonder, where did that come from? Well, it came from a lot of experiments. It came with trying things out and seeing where they're going, because a great deal of writing proofs involves that kind of behavior. Whew. All right. Thoughts, comments, questions, anything I can clarify for you? Okay, this concludes the new material for this class. As we've gone through the class, we've talked about numbers, we've talked about proofs, we've talked about state machines, we've talked about functions and sort of how they behave, these various tools that will be used to analyze our code. And as you go forward, you'll get to see many opportunities for all of these things to be used throughout computing. So as we come back on Friday, we will do a review. I plan to run that just as a Q&A. So if you come with no Qs, there will be no A's. I may do some sort of brief summary of content. And again, if you are sort of satisfied with where you sit with your grades right now, there is no need to take the in-class quiz on Monday or the final quiz on Friday. But if you want to have a chance to replace something, you're certainly welcome to do that. And I will see you on Friday.